We apologize for what we're about to do to you this hour. After the show, you'll be humming along with a lot of the great earworms, including this one picked out by Joy Cardine. Well, I'm Cynthia Schuster filling in for Joy Cardine, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Earworms are what you call those catchy songs that get stuck in your head for hours, if not days, after you hear them, maybe just once. Sometimes you don't have to hear them more than once to have them floating around in your mind. How does this happen? Our guest this hour explains the science of earworms. She's Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis, an associate professor and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas. She's the author of the book On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind, and a recent piece in The Atlantic called Why Songs Get Stuck in Your Head. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, you know, this is a big question, but why does this happen?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting that just 10 years ago, we wouldn't have been able to say anything at all in answer to that question. There was just no research on this subject. But in the last few years, people have started to do some studies. So we started to glean some kind of ideas about the science behind the experience of earworms. The first thing we've learned is really how prevalent they are. So there's been a number of kind of survey studies that have tried to get a handle on exactly how common earworms are among the general public. And it turns out that, according to a survey of more than 12,000 people, that more than 90% of people get tunes stuck in their head at least once a week. And about a fourth of them actually have several different episodes of earworms each day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of startlingly widespread.
How does the experience vary per person? I mean, what explains the fact that one person might only have one earworm a day and someone has several?
So there have been a couple of hypotheses about that. I would say the jury is still out a little bit, but there's some indication that people with higher levels of basic musicality are more susceptible to earworms. So if you're kind of an active performer or you listen to a lot of music or music is a big part of your life in some way, you might be endangering yourself a little bit on the earworm front. Similarly, this is a little more controversial, but there's been some indication that people who score higher on neurotic kind of personality traits or have more kind of obsessive-compulsive tendencies might also be more susceptible to earworms.
Have people compared notes as to what songs are stuck in their head, and are there, common themes there?
Yeah, you know, there's some work being done right now out of a lab at the University of Goldsmiths in London, and they're really working at trying to figure out what particular pieces tend to be associated with earworms. And there are, like the one that you just regaled your listeners with, there are certain songs that seem to be better candidates. And you know, interesting questions are, is that because they're played more often? Because we do have good evidence that the more a piece is repeated, the likelier it is to get stuck. But is it also something about the structure of those tunes? And I'd say one thing that might seem pretty obvious at first glance, but becomes a little more interesting the more you think about it, is that it really seems like a clear beat seems to be a prerequisite for a song getting stuck in your head in this way. So it would be hard to imagine an episode of Plain Chant, for example, mm-hmm. getting stuck in there. There's something about the way we're engaging with music when there's a beat, when we're predicting what's going to come next, and we can have some sort of sense of movement associated with what we're hearing that makes it grippier, tends to cling into there more than otherwise.
I don't know if you know the answer to this. What tune structures are you talking about here? What is it? What are the, I guess, note combinations that are hooking themselves into our brain?
Now, if people knew that for sure, you know, we'd be in big trouble. because, you know, advertisers already, you know that this happens and try to ride the phenomenon of the earworm so that their advertisement for their hot dog or whatever makes its way all the way into your subconscious and becomes a part of what you're humming long after you see their commercial. So thankfully, we don't have a clear formula that can produce a song that's going to be particularly catchy. But there are some things you can think about in terms of what makes a good hook. So things that have to do with distinctiveness of rhythmic pattern. I think rhythm seems to be really important. Also, if you have a tune that follows some kind of schema that lots of other tunes follow, so it's pretty easy to move along with it, but at the same time has some little departure that's interesting and distinctive. Those two things together, sort of being common and ordinary enough to be memorable, but also having something distinctive enough to make it jump out from all the other pool of melodies you might be encountering during your day.
I have to say, I don't turn the channel of my radio up the dial too much. I mean, I'm biased, I'm in public radio, but sometimes I'll listen to the top 40 stations in town just to have a break from everything. And everything sounds the same to me. And I didn't know if that was strategic, as you were saying, you know, maybe if we knew the combination of notes that would make a song stick, maybe every song would sound the same. So is it then just a coincidence that everything sounds the same to me? Or am I just not appreciating the uniqueness of, I don't know, Kanye West versus anybody else?
Yeah, I think there are lots of ways of looking at that. I mean, I'm definitely sympathetic to that impression. I think maybe the main phenomenon that's underlying that probably is simply that lots of studies in kind of psychoaesthetics, where you look at what kind of aesthetic stimuli, what kind of music, what kind of pictures, people tend to just most readily report enjoying or find interesting or whatever. Generally, they're in this sweet spot between too simplistic and too complex, so that they're familiar enough, but they're not overly simplistic, and at the same time that they've got something interesting going on. So I think what you'd find is a lot of those songs have these, you know, large kind of swaths of things that are they kind of common from one to the other, but they each have some little distinctive thing that they're bringing as well.
I was thinking about this. I think I woke up to this idea a couple of years ago. For example, why Cole Porter is a household name. His songs are so catchy and the melodies are so repetitive that you really can just hear, I Get a Kick Out of You once and it sticks. And I'm sure that's to account for a lot of his fame.
Yeah, that's a great example. Cole Porter is such a great example. Yes, musicians often talk about some people just having a gift for melody, because so many elements of music, it seems like, there's lots of good theory about, and you can study and kind of, you know, get yourself to be really great at part writing or, you know, figuring out harmonic progressions or whatever. But melody is relatively under-theorized in comparison to other dimensions of music, and it occupies a sort of mysterious realm where it's kind of like you've got it or you don't have it. Some of the things that people think about when they're thinking about the structure of melody have to do with not just the way one note follows the next note, but the entire shape of the melody. So when you think of what you might call a structural tone of the beginning of the melody, and then a structural tone of the middle of the melody, and a structural tone later. And if you have some kind of inevitable seeming progression across the course of not just the local events in the melody, but also the more background structural events, that can be really compelling.
When are we most vulnerable to succumbing to an earworm?
Be during episodes when we're not overly involved in the task that we're doing. So when something requires some degree of attention but kind of minimal resources. So if you're waiting in line or driving a car, those kinds of episodes in your day.
Our listeners are really going to be hearing The Lion Sleeps Tonight, I think, when they go to bed tonight. I'm talking with Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis. She is associate professor and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas. She's the author of the book On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. And we're talking about earworms this hour, the songs that get stuck in our head for hours, if not days on end. What song is that for you? You should let us know and share the fun with us. You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. You can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Why do you fill me up, Talking about earworms this hour, songs that get stuck in our heads all too easily. I believe this one is Christy's. Christy Taylor. This is the song that gets stuck in her head. So she'll be hearing that all day today. We're talking with Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis, associate professor of director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, and author of the book On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. We got an email from Bernard. He asks, are functional changes in the brain detectable by fMRIs? Seen in subjects while they're listening to an earworm? Have we seen that on MRIs, Elizabeth?
Yes. So the people who've done neuroimaging research on earworms have called it involuntary musical imagery. And basically, they've looked at what happens when people listen to music, really. So they're really listening to a song versus when they've got something stuck in their head. So it feels like you're listening to the song, but it's not actually really there in the acoustic environment. And kind of the take-home point from what they've found is that it looks pretty similar. So when you are imagining music in this way, it's really quite comparable to what it looks like when you're actually listening to real music out there in the world.
Really? Is there
it's
an explanation for that?
The power of the earworm.
Wow. Is there an explanation?
Well, it turns out that our musical imagery is really stunningly vivid. So a lot of things, if we try to imagine them when they're not really happening to us, we're not that great at it. But when we think about what it's like to listen to music, we can conjure up really quite veridically, quite accurately, what the music sounds like. And part of that has to do with the fact that when you're listening to music, lots of the systems that underlie movement, so motor planning and so forth, are active as well. So we really have musical listening grounded in a bodily way that some other experiences lack.
Do we have to know the words? I mean, do we have to know a song so well that we can actually sing the lyrics, or is it just the melody that sticks?
You know, that is a really great question. And as far as I know, that can vary from person to person, because you can certainly imagine people singing or, you know, the classic example, I think it was on VH1, there was a show called Motor Mouth for a while. I don't know if you know about this, but it was kind of a mean show that chronicled, unbeknownst to innocent drivers, their habits of singing along to the radio in the car.
Okay.
And lots of times it doesn't necessarily involve even the full words or anything. It might involve some kind of sympathetic grunting or just, you know, really enthusiastic headbanging. So sometimes it really is something about the tune and the melody, and you don't necessarily need to know the lyrics to be gripped by that.
Well, let's take a call from John in Richland Center. Hi, John.
Oh, my favorite earwig is Silly Love Songs by Paul McCartney. It was in the 70s that I fell in love with my high school sweetheart, and it was both of our favorite song. And I can still hear the words and the music today.
Oh, well, let's take a listen. Yeah, I could see how that would stick.
I think that's the sweetest earworm that's going to show up in this hour.
That probably will be. Now, is that it's been a long time since I've heard the entirety of that song. Is that really just how it goes, the same three notes over and over again? There's got to be a verse in there somewhere. Oh, we've lost a caller. Do you know, Elizabeth?
Oh, I don't know. I assume there's got to be.
I hope so. Otherwise.
But, you know, it's true that that kind of underscores that for most people, when you're hearing music in your head, it's not an entire song, which might be kind of nice. It's some catchy part of the chorus, usually, the part that's repeated most often in the song. And generally, when that burrows its way into your mind, it sets itself on repeat in your head. So that, you know, that music just did the same thing many times in a row. And then it gets stuck in your head and does the same thing many, many, many times more.
It did it for itself. But, and he mentioned, too, that he associates this with a positive memory. And I'm wondering if you've done any research on associations of music with memory.
Yeah, there's a pretty big literature on music and autobiographical memory. So the idea that music has this special ability to get welded with things that happen to us in our lives. So that can be referred to as the they're playing our song phenomenon, where, or for me, I went to music camp when I was growing up called Interlochen in Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
At the end of the summer, every year they play the same piece. They play Liszt, Les Preludes, and then the conductor breaks his baton and everybody cries because they have to leave and go home. And, you know, long after I'd grown up and really, you know, wasn't that emotionally invested in my high school camp experiences, Liszt, Les Preludes could come up on the radio and tears would just start, you know, coming. I couldn't figure out what it was about until I realized, oh, that's Les Preludes. So, yeah, there does seem to be this way that emotional experiences in our lives can glom onto music. And I think that that is can be relevant to how earworms are triggered. So something might remind you in some subtle way of something that you experienced while you were listening to a song, and that might trigger the song getting stuck.
Hallie in Madison has a question for us. Hi, Hallie.
Hi, I'm pregnant, and so I'm reading a lot of pregnancy books, and one of the things I keep reading is that if you listen to a song a lot during your pregnancy, the baby will recognize it when it's born. And I'm wondering, I don't know if that's true, but would that be sort of an earworm for an unborn baby then?
Wow, that's a great question. So we do know that babies are really great at recognizing and remembering things that they've heard when they're in utero. Whether or not that's ensconced in the form of an earworm or not, I don't know. That makes it seem like it has a potential dark side to playing lovely tunes for your baby. But as far as I know, I don't know about it being some kind of involuntary, horrible thing that happens to the infant. Or I think it's more just that they're familiar with that song, and so it seems like they tend to like it when they hear it because it's familiar.
You know what? 20 years ago, there was research about, maybe it was more than 20 at this point, the Mozart effect. And I know that a lot of expectant mothers would, some would put the headphones right on their stomach and play Mozart for their baby to hear. Is there any, I think that's been debunked, but what's your research say about that?
Yeah, so the Mozart effect really was, the original finding just showed that if you listened to this Mozart 2-piano sonata before you took a test about spatial reasoning, you could perform a couple of points better on that test. And the test was actually, that was about adults. It wasn't even about children in the first place. But then, secondly, it turned out that there wasn't something magical about Mozart. It really just reduced down to an arousal effect. So if you listen to any kind of vaguely upbeat music before you took a test, you'd do better at it. The same effect would hold if you ran on the treadmill. So really responses to that, so with some states issuing CDs of Mozart to all new mothers in the state, was really just exposed something about our ideas, pre-existing notions about what music's like, more than anything about what the data said about what music's like.
Let's go to Sheila in Wrightstown. Hi, Sheila.
Hello. This is a great topic. If a song is an earworm, I have a serious infestation. I get them every night while I'm sleeping, and it can just be the most random thing that I heard on the radio. And of course, it is that same thing. It's a half a line over and over and over again, to the point where I sometimes have to sit up and just say, all right, enough, shut up, you know. But my best one is Call Me Maybe by Carly Jepsen, and my 9-year-old finds great pleasure in finding that song wherever and whenever she can to play it for me to drive me crazy.
Oh, well, let me do the honor. Your daughter's not here, Sheila, so I thought I'd step in.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. So what about that, Elizabeth? Call Me Maybe. That was a pretty big hit about a year ago.
Yeah, and that's right about the time period that would make it most susceptible to earworms now. So you've heard it a lot in the relatively recent past, and then there's been a period where maybe you haven't heard it as much, and that's kind of ripe conditions for it cropping up and getting stuck in your head.
And then even Sesame Street went on to make a spoof of that as well, which I found preferable. Adam on Twitter writes, the A-Team and other old TV themes from my childhood are earworms for him. Let's take a listen. I think it's to the A-Team. Well, that's interesting. Would you say that that's a tune that would be easily embedded in your ear, Elizabeth?
Well, it has that sort of jaunty sense that you can really, you know, feel like you're moving along with. I mean, I think the thing about TV themes and so forth is think about the number of times you heard that if you were a child in the appropriate time, right? I mean, it's probably, I don't know, I guess for some kids, I bet it's dozens and dozens and dozens, right? And you're sitting there captivated in front of this. That's all you're listening to. And what happens across really repeated hearings of something is you're so able to predict exactly what's going to come next. You're really kind of moving along with the music. It no longer feels like you're just listening to it. It kind of feels like you're participating in a way. And again, that's really fertile ground for getting something ingrained in a kind of motor sequence type fashion, such that it can come out almost as a habit years later.
Well, in TV theme songs, I would say, anatomically speaking, kind of emulate commercial jingles too. And
absolutely,
I'm sure that those are written clearly with a marketing influence behind it, wanting it to be stuck in one's head so that when someone goes to the grocery store, they remember that product.
No question. Absolutely no question.
TV theme songs that get stuck in my head. I don't know if you remember the show Hey Dude from Nickelodeon or in the cartoon Gummy Bears from my childhood for some reason. Let's go to Coleman. Vern is waiting for us. Hi, Vern.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What's an earworm for you?
Yeah, I had occasionally at work when there's not too much going on, I'll end up getting the Schoolhouse Rock, get the lolly, 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 get your adverbs here. And then occasionally I'll get the theme song from Batman coming in, the early TV shows.
Yeah, so another TV theme song. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Well, I was just going to say that that demonstrates a sort of, we've looked at insidious ways that advertisers can manipulate this in order to make you think about hamburgers or something. But also children's television shows can often manipulate it to help you remember the names of all the countries or the names of all the presidents of the United States. So, you know, it can be used for good as well.
How would you suggest we have TV producers coming up with songs about adverbs or how a bill becomes law and those types of things? Can educators use music in their own way to hammer home a specific lesson? And I guess what would be your advice in doing so?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, my kids often come home with little ditties about whatever it is they're learning. And now with YouTube, you can very easily look up a subject your kids are learning on YouTube and find a fun song about it. I've got a friend who learned all the two-letter words in Scrabble by making up a song about it. So there, you definitely can hijack the capacity for songs getting stuck in your head to help you remember strings of information.
Now that you mention it, I still know the order of the planets thanks to a song that we learned in middle school. And it was to the tune of a familiar nursery rhyme or something.
Although those may no longer be the planets we agree on now.
That's true. Yeah, you're right. Pluto was there. I will still sing it with the pizza pies at the end of the song. Jenny in Bloomington. Hi, Jenny.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a coworker a couple days ago. I was complaining about deadlines and things I had to get done at work. And of course, this weather has been terrible. And he mentioned to me he started singing to me, "Don't Worry, Be Happy." And now that song is in my head since last Tuesday. So I thought that is one of those tunes that "Don't Worry, Be Happy." And then now it's just in my head forever now. I can't get it out. So now when I'm having even a bad, you know, not a great day, then it just pops in my head.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so that's another one.
There you have it.
The thing about that that's so stunning to me, really, is that it tends to be just that one little bit that repeats again and again and again. So I can't think of really any other kind of thing we listen to that ends up on repeat in our brains that way. And, you know, there's something about the relationship between how repetitive music is when we're thinking about it and how repetitive music is really out there in the real world.
Is there some sort of cue that we need to have in order for our mind to spark that song? She was saying that she hears "Don't Worry, Be Happy," and sometimes it could be apropos of nothing. It just pops up. But what is the unconscious cue that's bringing that song back?
So the way I think about that is the idea that so if you think about how habits are what enables us to have a habit when you look at what's happening in the brain. And the idea is you have sort of an entry point where something begins, and then it kind of executes automatically, and then there's an exit point. And tunes are a little bit like that. We can't just duck into the middle of a tune and think about what this particular note is like. We have to sing the tune through until we get to that note. And so the reason that relates to stickiness is that you can't think about just any little bit of the tune. If your brain flits over any little segment of it or anything about the tune, the whole thing has to play through. And I think that's really part of the problem. Almost anything else you think about, you could just think about and then stop thinking about. But with music, the way you're representing it is in these chunks. So you can really get stuck, and I think that's the real problem.
Hmm. When did the earworm originate? I mean, is this something that we've always, as a species, dealt with? When did people start complaining about it or talking about it?
That's such a great question, because one thing you might suspect is that perhaps it wasn't until we had all this recording technology that subjected us to really exact repetitions of the same music again and again that we were even susceptible to this at all. But there are some fun evidence that illustrates that it couldn't be a result of modern recording technology. One example is a story by Mark Twain in an issue of The Atlantic in the 1870s, before Thomas Edison had invented the gramophone, where he writes about this town that's been overtaken by this, you know, sinister earworm. So clearly it was something that was out there and people were experiencing even before contemporary recording technology.
I think we have a caller that has a comment along those lines as well. Martha in Westby. Hi, Martha.
Hello, I do indeed. When I was a kid, I went to one of those one-man shows that is a Mark Twain event, and he spoke about that town and his way of having people get that tune out of their heads was based on the porters on the railroad. And I always tell my kids this when they get something stuck in their head. It goes, "A blue trip slip for an 8 cent fare, a bus trip slip for a 6 cent fare, a pink trip slip for a 3 cent fare, punch it in the presence of the passenger. Punch, brothers, punch with care, punch it in the presence of the passenger." And you just keep repeating that, and eventually your earworm is gone.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
And it really works.
You'll have to email in those lyrics. I didn't catch all that, but that was fun. Thanks, Martha. We got an email from Perry. Perry says, "My earworm is 'It's a Small World' from Disney World." Mm-hmm. And they say, now I just gave it to myself. "The only way to get rid of an earworm is to implant a worse one." Well, we'll enjoy a little bit of "It's a Small World" after all, as we talk about earworms this hour with Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis. She's associate professor of and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas. She's the author of the book On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about earworms this hour with Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis, Associate Professor and Director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas. She's the author of the book On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. The song we just heard was An Earworm of Robin Cherry. She picked that out today as we were talking about what songs get stuck in our heads. I'll play mine a little bit later. You can hear it. It's from the 1950s, I believe. And what is your earworm? You can call in and let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Let's take a call from... Oh, let's take a call from Dave in Appleton. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I sure couldn't top that last lady's, but anyway. It seems like most of the callers have been have had one earworm that stays with them for years, and I get these things every 2 weeks, and at the moment it's No Place Like Home for the Holidays, and it came long after Christmas. I don't know how it popped in, but next week there's going to be a different one. And I am a musician, so it was interesting what she said earlier about maybe we get them worse. I don't know.
Yeah, how often would you say you get earworms? Are you always thinking about music?
Well, yeah, I suppose in the subconsciously at least, but they just pop out of nowhere. It's not like something that stays with me for years or something.
Well, thanks.
I'm just wondering if it's a different part of the brain or something, or works that way. But yeah.
Thanks for your call, Dave.
There are people who have really extreme cases of earworms, and one name that's been proposed for this kind of condition is perpetual music track, and that was suggested by Stephen Brown, who's a neuroscientist at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He's a pianist as well as a neuroscientist, and he reports that he has music playing in his head all the time. So he just simply, quite simply, can't make it stop, and it really interferes with his life. I mean, it's just these short little bits of music repeating and repeating all the time. Often he finds himself fingering out the way you'd play it on the piano as it's going through his head. So the kinds of cases that earworms have for people really runs the gamut from relatively innocuous to something that really interferes seriously with your life.
Have you seen an uptick, I guess, in earworms since the proliferation of things like iPods, where it almost seems we're always surrounded by music now?
Now, that is such a fascinating question that, sadly, we really missed the opportunity to explore in some ways, because it's only in the last few years, since those technologies have already become prevalent, that people have started doing this work to try to track how common they are and so forth. We simply don't have data from before that. I mean, I guess one thing you could do would be collect data from a place where those technologies were less prevalent, but no one's done that yet.
Let's talk to Jan in Rice Lake. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I'm 61 years old, and I'm not musically inclined at all, and I don't like noise. But the ones that stick in my head are the real popular ones, pop music. Like right now, it's a song called Light It Up. And I don't even know where I heard it, but I cannot get this song out of my head.
Yeah, I think one of the things about pop music is that you're hearing it a lot in context where even if you're not, you know, yourself turning it on the radio in your car, it's just around in the ambient environment. So I notice when I park my car in the garage in the morning, they're playing kind of top 40 music over the sound system in the garage. So there's just this way that it's kind of creeping in, maybe even outside of your choice. And we do have good neuroimaging data that show that the limbic system and kind of regions of your brain that underlie emotional experience are more active for familiar music, whether or not you report liking that music. So it's kind of creeping in there and moving you in some way outside of your volition in some cases.
We have an email from Kendra. I'm an elementary music teacher. Earworms are my occupational hazard. The songs that are easy for kids to learn are the same ones that run through my head at 2 a.m. The worst song ever for me was Yellow Submarine by the Beatles. I had that one stuck for almost a year. Oh, let's take a listen. That familiar melody will repeat itself a couple of times in that song, and I could see how that might stick. But wow, for a year, that's a long time.
Yeah, that's a long time. You know, and I don't know that we have good data to support this yet, but I have this sort of intuition that it might be worse if you sing along. So the more you're overtly participating, the worse it might be. I don't know that that's true, but that's a little pet theory I have.
Are there little exercises we can do to suppress those earworms? Like, I imagine if there's a song that we really enjoy, it's not as annoying to have it stuck in our head. But if it's something like Yellow Submarine, which maybe you like the song, but not for every day for a year, how do you train your mind out of it?
Well, the kind of suggestions I've heard, generally people talk about just thinking about another song, which might seem kind of circular. But sometimes you can get yourself out. If you can just get one in there that's a little less sticky, then you can get out of that one then more easily. Or turning your attention to something that is really taxing. So, you know, they're most liable to occur when you're not using your full attentional resources. So if you can start doing some higher math or something, it might help get it out.
Really? Well, then you have to do math.
Right.
No. I just remembered that I saw Amy Sedaris. She's a comedian, sister of David Sedaris, as many public radio listeners are familiar with him. She was on The Tonight Show or something, or Colbert Report or something. She said the way to get a song out of your head is just to sing to yourself, "Bye, Menon." Like the deodorant commercial from the 80s, which I tried that once, and then I was just singing that over and over again in my head. So that,
right, at least that one's short. So.
Yeah, yeah. Rod in Weyerhauser is next. Hi, Rod. What's your question or comment?
Well, I was just going to comment. I think sometimes it has to do with when you're doing certain things, like if they're repetitious, because I plant a lot of potatoes, and it seems like I think back every time I was planting potatoes, it's like it speeded the process up because I'd go La Bamba. And I don't even know all the words, but I just keep going, like, thinking in my head, you know, and I'd start humming it then because in my head, and I'd be going, da-da-da-da-da-da, plant the potatoes or something like that, you know. It just seems like it makes the work go easier, you know, but that one always comes to my head when I'm planting potatoes or digging them, you know. I don't know if that is because it's just, you know, this repetitious.
Well, that's because it's really tied into your motor system, really. So even when people aren't doing something that's physical like that, they'll often, if you have an earworm, the way you know someone else has one is they'll start humming it. It's just sort of, you can't suppress it. So if you can harness that and, you know, use that tendency to move along with it to accomplish some task, I think that that's great.
Maybe singing it out loud gets it out of your head in a way, and then that's one way to clear your mind, I suppose.
Maybe, yeah.
James in Eau Claire County. Hi, James.
How are you this morning?
We're well. What's an earworm for you?
The Rolling Stones' Sympathy for the Devil. And I'll tell you the story behind it. Now, the fact that I have a degree in philosophy and history and I'm a published poet may make a difference, but that's the first song I recall hearing after I got home from Vietnam in 1968. I hear it every now and then. I'm convinced it's in response to seeing something evil. And trust me, I know something about evil.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it is probably the earliest example of what is now called lit rock. The song is brilliant. And, I mean, you know, you could read C.S. Lewis and you know, in any of the accounts of Lucifer. And it's, they hit the mark with that one. But 1968, that's been more than a year.
Mm-hmm. Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones. I'm not familiar with that song myself. Are you, Elizabeth?
I'm not either, I'm sorry to say. But it does sound, that account sounds consistent with this idea that once music gets really tightly associated with a certain experience, the song can be triggered by encountering something that is reminiscent of that experience in some way.
And musically speaking, a song can have an uplifting ability. It can also have a lot of gravity. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with the way in which it's arranged, not just composed in the melody, but the arrangements that back up that melody. Do you have any knowledge about that?
Sure. Well, you know, one thing that can happen is you can have kind of a slow melody, and if it's underscored by some kind of really exciting fast beat, that's this particular kind of sense where, you know, on the surface, the way people sing, the person singing, it all seems very calm and slow, but there's something underneath that's really rousing, and I feel like that can be the sort of thing that gets stuck in your head and causes this sort of uplifting impression.
Jim emails, I play the song Little Willie for my 4-year-old daughter, and then she'll sing it all day long. I'm wondering if there are certain age groups that are more susceptible to earworms.
That's also a fascinating question that we don't know much about yet. So I don't know about any studies that look at earworms across the course of the lifespan. I certainly know from experience with my own kids that kids are prime candidates, but I don't know how young it goes or how old you need to be before they start. That really would be a fascinating question.
Tracy in Spring Green, thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm an actor. I'm a theater actor. Okay, buddy. Sorry, and I'm also a mom. That was my son. Today's a snow day because it's so cold, so he's with me today. I'm a theater actor, and so I learn lines all the time, learn them and dump them. But the most commonly asked question from audiences to us is, how do you learn all those lines? And I have, for years, I've made up this scientific notion in my head that it's just like learning songs. And I always tell them that. I say, if you listen to a song on the radio, particularly a popular one that gets played over and over again, suddenly you're singing it and you don't know how you ever learned it. I actually think that's how actors learn lines. We have to repeat them over and over again in rehearsal, and suddenly we know them. And I wondered if there's any truth to that, if there's a link between a repetition of any sort.
Yeah, that's a really exciting question because, you know, but lots of times when cognitive scientists are trying to understand music, they look at it in comparison to language. And one of the best kind of dividing points we have between language and music is precisely repetition. So there's this really intriguing illusion that if you just look around and Google for, or maybe you can post it on your website, it's Diana Deutsch's finding about the speech to song illusion. And Diana Deutsch is a psychologist at the University of California at San Diego. And what happens in this illusion is that you just hear somebody speak a few sentences, and then you take a little segment from those sentences and you repeat it a number of times, like 10 times in a row, say. And then you play the original collection of sentences again, just exactly like you heard it the first time. But now, when you hear it, everything sounds just normal until you get to the part that was repeated. And suddenly, it sounds like you're in a Disney movie, and the speaker has just burst out into song. So simply by repeating something, you can cause yourself to hear something that previously was unambiguously speech, and hear it instead clearly like song. So there is this really interesting way that the simple act of repetition can musicalize speech.
Let's take a listen to a song that was quite a hit, I think, a couple of years ago now. And I think that you had suggested this, Elizabeth. We'll talk about what makes it unique in this way. Here we go.
The sky.
That's Rolling in the Deep by Adele. What made this song catch on so quickly and probably stick in our heads?
You know, lots of songs sort of have a section that's really catchy. They have some kind of hook, and then there's this other stuff in between. And that one really just takes really catchy hook-like material and just concatenates it. So you have one episode like that, and then another episode like that, and then another episode. So that really is a particular kind of den of earworms.
And I can hear the layers you were talking about earlier of having, here she's holding out an extended note, but behind her, the backup singers and the band are bringing in the solid beat.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Abe in Milwaukee, you're next.
Hi, this is Abe from Milwaukee. I'm a composer, and sometimes it's interesting what you're talking about as an earworm. We sometimes call what you just used a hook. And I coined the term ear fuzzy because the earworm kind of sounds negative to me. And when I have this little hook that just I really enjoy listening to, and it's a fuzzy sound. It's an ear fuzzy. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Well, I'll say that we have things actually relatively positive in English because the French word for earworm translates to stubborn music, and the Italian word for earworm translates to tormenting songs. So compared to those, earworms are relatively innocuous.
An email from Chris. I'm a deer hunter, and for much of the time, I am simply sitting quietly and waiting. During these times, I will begin to hear on repeat a song or album I've been listening to. One hunting season, all I could hear was a Ben Folds album. Well, that's interesting. I wouldn't think of Ben Folds, I don't think, while I'm sitting out there in the hunting camp, but that he can be a fun musician to listen to as well.
Yeah, and if he's able to listen to a whole album, he's really way ahead of the rest of us because most people can't get out of this one little loop that they're stuck on. It tends to be about 15 seconds long, and that's the part about earworms that makes them less fuzzy often, is that it's just this one little bit, and it won't seem to go away.
Let's take one last call from Linda in Boulder Junction. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I'm calling because back in 1978, I would play Simon and Garfunkel's The Boxer for my infant daughter every day and sing along with it. This is when she was like 1 to 4 months old. I love that song and the album, and she'd fall asleep during it. And then when she was 16 in high school, they were discussing a social studies class. They played that song and discussed it, and she came home and said, "Mom, we talked about this song in class today, and the teacher played it." And she said, I've never heard it before, but I knew the song." And you know, she came home just kind of all excited, was wondering how in the heck that could be. And I told her I played that a lot way back when you were a baby. You know, it was something that we hadn't really played since. So that was kind of a strange moment for us.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. I mean, one of the really interesting things about music is years later, I mean, you might not have heard a song for 2 decades, and you can just hear the opening little chords, and the rest of the song kind of unfolds in your mind. So we have this really nice verbatim representation of the song still stored in there. It just takes something to trigger and to access it.
Well, Elizabeth, we just have about a minute left. What earworm has been bugging you this week?
I have to say that during our conversation, ever since you played the It's a Small World, that one stuck for me.
Yeah, I imagine that everyone sort of woke up and started their day with their own earworm, and this hour we have swept them away and introduced a whole slew of them. Well, what's next in your research on earworms and in music cognition?
Well, a lot of my work right now is looking at what happens when you introduce extra repetition or take away repetition to music that's out there in the real world.
Great. Well, we look forward to learning more and hope to have you back.
And thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Sure. That's Elizabeth Helmuth Margulis. She's associate professor and director of the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas. She's also the author of On Repeat, How Music Plays the Mind. We'll close tonight with my earworm. This is Lollipop by the Cordettes, a Sheboygan-based group. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. Thanks to Christy Taylor for producing the hour and for on-air direction. Marika Suval provided on-air production. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.